There he is.
Oh, we're not doing that?
Well, we're on the record, we might as well. So, let me open the House Rural Communities Committee, and we're going to start by discussing the fact that this is my vice chair's last meeting because he's been appointed to the Marion County Commission.
Uh-huh.
And, yeah, it came through.
Now we can do it, huh?
Yay!
And luckily for me, he will still be in the vicinity of striking distance of being able to work with us on projects. But for the rest of you who've enjoyed working with Representative Kamen over the years, it is a real loss to the legislature. It's a gain to our county, but it's a loss to the legislature to lose his acumen, his pragmatism, his commitment, his public service, his charming sense of humor and smile. And we've got a mission.
Mr. Chair, I will be right down the street, and I'll probably bug you more than ever on issues that we have to deal with. I think I'm going to say this: we're on the record.
We're on the record.
Right?
Let it fly.
I called Representative Clem last week to say one of the issues that, whether we agree or disagree, I think we could all agree that snowpack is changing in our state, and Marion County being the number one agricultural county in the state, obviously we have to do something about water storage, and we can't store it. I think we'll agree that the storage in snow form is going down, and what are we going to do long term to be able to have water storage for our agricultural community here in Marion County is something that I think this particular committee or even the Ag Committee can take up as an issue, and I'll be heavily involved in following that and see how we can do that over the long haul, preparing for obvious changes that are happening. So I know you didn't want me to say that as parting words, but I will take an interest in what's happening here because we're all interrelated, and state government, county government, city government have to work to learn to work together, and so I appreciate the experience that I've had here and the relationships that I have here, and don't take those for granted. We'll continue to work together. So thank you very much.
Well, you will be happy to know that after that call yesterday, I had water resources in my office already getting a list of ideas. And then our good friend Representative Gilliam, which he doesn't usually pay attention to details, last night said, yeah, let's talk about the East Valley Irrigation District and their water project. And I thought you put him up to it because there's no way he would have just come up with that on his own, I felt. But no, sure enough, you didn't. And he seemed to already know that this needed attention. So
he just doesn't remember me putting him up.
So there's a critical mass gathering around water. But for the moment, we're going to talk about a different type of water. That's the part we sail on and go out and do research on. So, Vice Chair McEwen, do you want to talk a little bit about this before we get going? I think you were quite responsible for having us learn about this today, and then we'll get our guests up.
Well, I just thought it would be appropriate to at this committee level learn a little bit about what's going on over on the coast in regards to the research vessel. This is a project that we invested in the last session. It's a very exciting prospect, not only for Oregon State students, but I think even beyond. We're doing some interesting things over there, and I'm really looking forward to Mr. Mills and his friends coming up and telling us what's happening over on the coast with the research vessel.
Great, good. So why don't we get into it? I will let folks know that at I think 10 sharp, I think we're probably going to recess for about 10 minutes rather than just half of us disappear randomly and you're wondering why. Is it something you said? We have a bill signing upstairs that won't take long, and I think we've got enough extra time. We're just going to recess the committee just before 10 and go up, and I won't call it what people don't want me to call it, but it was the land use related bill about the map in Washington County. I think I'm supposed to call it the map adjustment consensus bill rather than the other one that nobody wants to hear about apparently anymore. So
MACB.
Yeah, MACB. So let's get into our ocean-going research vessel program presentation, and we have Alejandra and Jack. Jack, are you coming up or just sending him up? Okay, come on up.
Thank you.
I'd like to remind everybody in the room they are from Oregon State University, not the University of Oregon.
But they want to vote. I want to see.
Yeah. Okay. Welcome, Beavers.
Thank you. Good morning. Chairman Clem, I'm Jack Barth from Oregon State University. I'm in the College of Earth, Ocean, and Atmospheric Sciences, so that's a real mouthful.
Mm-hmm.
We used to be ocean and atmospheres, and we merged with geology and geography, so now we cover everything. And I'm here with Alejandra Sanchez, who I'll introduce in a little more detail later, to tell you about this really exciting program that you helped us get going. So I just want to thank you right off the bat for providing that investment in the research vessel program and tell you about what we're doing with it. So the main goals were to provide the chance to go to sea and take measurements about our changing ocean. We just heard about changing snowpacks. The ocean is changing, and we want to be able to get out there and make measurements that tell us what's going on. And secondly, we want to make sure the next generation of students and researchers and technicians know how to do this. I mean, I've been at OSU now 25 years. I'm good for a little bit longer, but we've got to hand off to the next generation. So there is a there's a strong training aspect on this that reaches up and down the coast, and I'll go into that in just a minute. So changes in the ocean. We want to be able to assess ocean health. We want to keep that sustainable, healthy ecosystem going. We want to map the territorial sea because there's more activities there. We need to know what's out there, what's on the bottom, what it's like. Understanding ocean dynamics, so currents, things that push around our vessels, we need to know those for search and rescue. The upwelling that drives our really strong ecosystem. We also use the vessel to install instruments. These are things that tell us about the ocean. We can get the data back to our desks and interpret it for the changes we're seeing. And lastly, some of the big issues you've heard about in our ocean are it's warming up, the sea level's rising, and we're having more low oxygen events, and now ocean acidification, which is the actual changing of the pH in the ocean that affects the baby organisms as they try to grow their shells. And I think the legislature understood that we have to get out there in a vessel and make these measurements. We can't do it from satellites. We can't do it from computers. And we don't want to have our students just be on the web all the time grabbing stuff willy-nilly. They have to know how to get that data and make good, accurate measurements. So that, it's all about getting to sea. And this training for Alejandra and others. We also noticed that to make our students competitive, they have to have this experience. They have to be the chief scientist on a vessel. Usually that's someone like me that has 10 or 15 years experience. But this was a chance with your guys' support to let them run the show and become the chief scientist. And Ali will tell us about that. So per the HB 3451 and your guys' guidance, we set up the Research Vessel Council. And on the reverse of the handout we gave you, it lists the membership. These were appointed by OSU President Ray. I'm the chair. But we have excellent representation from four agencies that relate to the ocean, Oregon Department of Fish and Wildlife, Land Conservation and Development, DOGAMI, and lastly, environmental quality.
And it was nice of you to include the U of O on the group too. Ben, Representative will be happy about that.
I was actually coming down to that. On the academic side, we did invite Craig Young from Oregon Institute of Marine Biology out on the coast of Charleston near Coos Bay. Craig has been a terrific colleague. We're also pleased to be joined by Kristen Wilkin from Clatsop Community College. This was really neat in bringing in both the Astoria North Coast side, but they have a marine technician training program there. So it's a perfect fit where they can come down on our vessel and work alongside the scientists and learn about the technical aspects of running vessels. And then we have good representation from Captain Blake from the NOAA fleet, which is now down in Newport, and then our Marine Superintendent. So we held an open competition. The bill was written that state agencies and academic faculty and students could apply. And we had a good competition. We selected three projects, and they're described on the front of the handout. And I'll just briefly say what they are, and then I'm going to turn it over to Ali to tell you about the cruise she was just on. These will all be conducted between April of this year and May of next year, and we'll come back and report to you guys in more detail. The first one's about mapping the seafloor and using instruments right on the bottom to see what the to characterize the bottom. How stable is it? What are the sediments doing? All towards thinking about how to anchor and install renewable energy devices offshore. So we just don't know. We can see the top of the ocean. We've got to get out there in the vessel and measure the things on the seafloor. The second one is a great opportunity for undergraduate training. This will be held during spring break of next year, March of 15. And we'll open that up to all the institutions, academic institutions across the state, and take the students out off Cape Perpetua. And in that area, the Umpqua River dumps out a fair bit of sediment. It moves around offshore. We really don't know exactly where. We've got to measure that. But it's that sediment coming back onshore that affects the shoreline. So we see changes in our shoreline, both to rising sea level and storminess. We need to know about the sand supply. The last cruise was just held in April, and it was led by graduate students, and it was to go down off the Cape Perpetua Marine Reserve and study how the ocean works both outside and inside the reserve, so we can get some knowledge of what's going on with the chemistry and the biology, and how will we in the future see how the marine reserve system is working that we've put in place in Oregon. I should say that this is a great program we've funded for 2 years. We're going to fund these three projects. The OSU Board of Trustees has recommended that this go into the next budget in the biennium, which we would be quite pleased to see. I want to stop now and introduce Ali. She's a third-year graduate student in physical oceanography, so we're actually both physicists. And we apply our knowledge of physics to the ocean. She recently just got a Women Leadership Award from OSU, so that was really neat to see. And she serves as what we call the chief scientist, that's in charge of the vessel, which is a pretty heady experience for a graduate student. So I can turn it over to Ali, or if there are questions.
Vice Chair McKeon.
Oh, thank you, Chair Clem. Dr. Barr, thank you so much for being here today. We on the coast, our small rural communities on the coast are going to benefit greatly from what you're doing, particularly over in Newport, but it's going to have broad-based effect. One thing I think it might be helpful to people who are listening to explain is exactly what we are doing with this investment. We had a $300,000 dedicated to this program, but would you explain, we're not buying a boat, we're not buying a vessel. Could you just kind of explain what exactly that money's doing?
Yes. So first, Chairman Clem, Vice Chairman McCown, I'd like to say that, you know, we've been operating a vessel for 50 years at OSU. We're very proud of that tradition. This is a 175-foot vessel. It's owned by the National Science Foundation and operated by Oregon State University. There are day fees to use that vessel for the technician time and very high fuel costs with recent prices and diesel prices. So the investment, the $300,000, goes towards paying for the operational costs for the days. And the cost of the vessel is $25,000 per day. So we can do 12 days with this effort.
Thank you.
Sure. So, Ali.
Thank you. Hi. First, I want to thank the legislature for this great opportunity. As a graduate student and part of this program, I have benefited a lot from this class and the boat time. First, I would like to say a little bit about what we did with the boat.
Ali, we need to have you say your name for the record.
Oh, that's sorry.
Fine. No problem.
My name is Alejandra Sanchez.
Thank you. So
I was part of this group of graduate students who participated in the cruise. The cruise was to take measurements of biological, chemistry, and physical measurements in the Perpetua Reserve, Marine Reserve, and out of it. The students, we were all in charge of actually planning analyzing the data, taking the samples, and responsible for the results. And we're still in that process. So what we did was a first 4-day study out of the coast in Perpetua, and we took water samples in the reserve and out of it, and we also did a lot of we trained in cutting edge technology, for example for underwater vehicles and robots that we can measure the currents, can measure the temperature, can measure salinity, and with this kind of properties we can tell the state of the ocean in that time that we were there. So let me tell you a little bit of the group of people who went in this boat. We were graduate students and undergraduate students, and plus the teachers and the professors who help us plan this event, this study. From the graduate students, we were part of two institutions. We were from OSU and also University of Oregon. And we were grad students from the areas of biochemistry and the areas of physical oceanography. So there was a nice interdisciplinary study and a good opportunity to work with different type of backgrounds. And from the undergrad, there were students from OSU, actually a student who came with us as part of the Navy, and then also from Astoria, from the college classroom, who were taking, they were part of the maritime science program, and that was a great opportunity for us to know, to get to know students that are part of this, the world of growing in research vessels and study, but they have another perspective, another view, because they're in charge that everything goes safely, that everything goes successfully, and just getting to know them too, and that start of us both being students, I think it's an opportunity that I don't think a lot of people have, and it's really valuable because we get to know each other more too. So this was a group of grad students at the beginning of the program. We got together, and as Jack mentioned, we also decided on roles, and this is something I have never experienced as a graduate student, where you actually have to, you could be a principal investigator in a research and take this more like your own research. And you're in the shadow of a professor, so it's a great opportunity to train those techniques of leadership, techniques of actually taking responsibility for the measurements you're taking it, and we knew this great opportunity, we knew the amount of money that it meant, and we knew we had to take it like really, really seriously. So it was both educational in a science way that we were able to have take measurements of this maritime reserve, and I'm really excited to see the results that are going to come up with it as both groups, biochemical and physical, are getting together. And then just the educational of being part of making the choices, making the responsibility choices of where to measure, how to measure, and that's something that I never thought I would have as a graduate student. It will be an experiment. It will be a really good program for COAS to have this constantly, because we need that when we graduated to know that, okay, I know what this means, I know what to be a principal investigator is and what it comes from, and I think I'm really grateful that I was part of this. Thank you.
So any questions about the program or about things that have been talked about so far?
I'll touch on one thing,
if you don't mind.
Chair Clem. Dr. Barth, you mentioned ocean acidification, I believe, and I think it's, I don't want to miss an opportunity to raise awareness of the fact that what's happening right now is has the potential and is beginning to dramatically impact our oyster growing industry. Seed production right now is very, very difficult, and we're trying to figure out and do research on how we can deal with the issue of ocean acidification and how it is impacting the potential for seed production for our oyster growers all up and down the coast. So there are really very practical applications for work that's going to be done by these students on the research vessel, and the opportunities to do just groundbreaking work in what our future is going to look like with this industry is really important to take note of. So these are very applicable projects that are happening out there over time, and this investment in this research vessel is something that those of us on the coast take very seriously. So thank you.
So you're in the Perpetua Reserve now. Is that the main sort of target for, I don't know all the right exact terms, but you've got a control group of outside and inside the reserve. Are you doing it in the other reserves too, or just that one for the time being?
That's the right characterization, Chairman Clem, for the inside and outside.
I was in the poli-sci area. I so didn't listen so much.
It turns out that the central coast, where the ocean floor widens dramatically, is a very important place along the entire Oregon coast, and that's why the early focus is on the Cape Perpetua area. But you're correct that these similar studies should be done at the other marine reserve sites, both further north and down off the south coast. Mm-hmm. This is just a start.
Yep.
And Dr. Barth, the nexus between the work that you're doing in that marine reserve, I'm assuming that this is all going to be shared with the work that the state is doing in implementing all five of these marine reserves. Is that correct?
Yeah, Chairman Clem and Vice Chair McCown, that's exactly right, that ODF&W is our partner on this. And they're actually conducting studies on the shallow side of things. Our vessel doesn't go into 10 or 15 meters of water. We study just slightly offshore of that, so it's a really nice partnership for them working on the shallower side of things. And back to the ocean acidification, when the challenges were first seen in the hatchery for the little baby oysters, the solution was to look to the ocean. And it turns out the water that was being brought into the tanks from the ocean was low in pH. And it was not a local effect by an estuary. It was not something they were doing wrong in the hatchery. It was the source water. And so what Allie and others are studying is how that comes from offshore and makes it right up into the hatcheries. And by monitoring those levels of pH, we can get ahead of the curve and predict when are good times or bad times to pull the water in.
So I'm on Google Earth here. Is the Perpetua the reserve then, like outside Winchester Bay and not up? I think of Cape Perpetua as further north, that we don't pass the Siusla even, but you described the Umpqua drainage. So is it not where
Perpetua is? Yeah, so a little bit of underwater geography. That bank I talked about goes offshore and reaches from Newport down to the Umpqua. So the southern range of that bank is the Umpqua River. But you're absolutely right. The reserve is much further north. It's up near Yahats.
But you're doing measurements closer to the mouth of the river.
That will be during the undergraduate cruise next March. They'll be looking at the Umpqua River dynamics.
So I've been fishing that river. My dad lives in that river. If I provide you a list of lost fishing poles and other, at any chance that you might, I don't know, like one of those fun islands that I don't know where that went. That floated downstream last year.
Wrong river.
We'd be happy to do that. I'm sure our site scan sonar could pick that up.
Okay, that's good. It's a pretty nice pole. Fish broken off. Anyway, any other serious questions? Representative Holy.
Thanks. Ocean acidification is, a big issue. And, besides just the clams, I assume that you're looking at other biological impacts of that and trying to figure out what's going to happen in the future. Are you making projections about what it might do to salmon and other wildlife? We keep hearing about things that are new, like pelicans in the Columbia River, and just all sorts of changes going on in our ocean world.
Chair Clem and Representative Hobie, I think you hit on the key word. It's changes, and how are we going to keep track of it? And you're right, it's not just the oysters. It's there's another marine snail out there called a pteropod, and it's a food for the salmon. It makes a shell that's being degraded by acidity and low pH. People refer to them as the potato chips of the sea. And we're studying those. We're studying the urchins. We're studying Dungeness crabs. So it's across a number of species. And you're right about the predictions. So if we know the projections for that offshore water, the pH is going to go down by this much. We can project that forward and how it'll come up near shore.
So this may seem like a flippant question, but what would be the solution to changing the pH of the ocean?
excellent question. There's two issues to this. There's a global issue. We know that the acidity is going up because we're putting man-made CO2 into the ocean. There's a local issue about where there are bad places, where there are good places. So much like land use on the land, we know where there's good places for farming. We know where there's good places to put cities. You want to understand enough about the ocean that you can make use of it well. You don't want to. There will be places where the acidity is lower compared to other places due to ocean processes. So we want to get that geography and then adapt. That's the key word, to adapt to the changes and place, you know, make good use of the ocean in different places. So the only way we're going to change the CO2 on a global level is through our what we decide to do as citizens of this planet. But on a local level, we can understand where our more vulnerable places and less vulnerable, and adapt in that way.
Yeah, Vice Chair Cameron.
You mentioned CO2 levels. Is there any measurement on that coming off of forest fires and getting into the watershed? I mean, is there any talk about measuring that specifically?
Yeah, Chair Clement, Vice Chair Cameron.
Comes out as a result of that.
Yeah, I think what you're trying to connect is through the forests to and forest fires and that kind of land use management. In our college, we have scientists that are looking directly at two things: the CO2 flux in and out of a forest. They make measurements at towers up in the trees and look at that in and out, and then if there are fires, how that might change. We're making CO2 measurements offshore and in the water, and we're making them on land, so we can make that connection.
Other questions? I kind of want to ask you about gyres while you're here, but we've got other people. I want to know more about this. My wife alerted me to this and started showing me pictures, but a gyre isn't actually the trash. It's more a system, but sometimes people refer to these giant trash islands as gyres too, I think. But what do we know about those? Any of the things that are being done to try and reduce that helping? Are they getting bigger? I know this isn't your topic, but this is a pop quiz.
I tell you what, yeah, Chairman Clement, I'll let the pop quiz go about gyres go to Ali, and then
good move.
Maybe I can follow up with the debris part of it.
All right.
Okay. Thank you, Chair Reclam. So I think what you talk about is that most of the different scales on the ocean, there are different dynamics happening because of the currents, the wind acting on the water, and gyres and eddies are something that occurs in different scales throughout the ocean in the Pacific and the Atlantic. And I think that the big trash one is like all the north part of the Pacific, for example, has this huge gyre coming from down to California, that the currents from the coast and going all the way to the other side of the Pacific. And this is accumulating the trashes that the human trash that we're throwing into the ocean. And those are like the circles, and this eddies use this cycles and eddies move around the ocean around sometimes, but they keep that focus. It's like a little circle that is keeping everything inside. And I think the only way to change it is also I don't know if there's something that we can actually do to remove the trash from the debris from those eddies and cycles. But it's definitely to show what we throw into the ocean, it just doesn't disappear. It doesn't. We saw the currents go. They go actually somewhere, and we can see it. And that's the importance of it. Sometimes with the ocean is so big, it's hard to understand that. For me, it starts with if I drop something to the ocean, it's so big it will disappear, but it actually will climb right and it will show up, and that's a big problem of them.
Do we know, is there any sense of measurement? I know it's 1,000 miles offshore, but is it still growing? I mean, you see a variety of efforts to reduce things that aren't biodegradable from just the waste supply in general, more recycling, but are we making any headway on this, or do we know?
Yeah, Chairman Clement, Ali's description was perfect there. These huge gyres with very quiet areas in the middle where we're accumulating the garbage that we're putting into the sea. And you're right, it's plastics and other non-biodegradables. I want to bring one visual image, though. You guys may have heard that this is the size of Texas. Well, it's not, all the garbage is not in one place. It's not like you go out there and there's an island of trash you can walk across. It's very dispersed. And it breaks down into little pieces and it affects the food web. So we don't see it, and we're not going to be able to drag nets through it and get it out of there. It's on a tiny scale. So you are correct. We need to keep going after the use of recyclables and keeping things out of the ocean. But to our knowledge, the garbage patches are still increasing.
Sorry, off topic. Since you're ocean people, I figured I'd totally wade into it while you're here.
Clearly.
I'll throw something. I learned something this week in our Coastal Caucus meeting. It's an award I had not heard, and it's called a nurdle. And a nurdle is something that's creating a huge problem in the ocean, and they are the feedstock for the plastics industry, and they're small pellets that get transported across the ocean. They lose containers now and then. Nurdles end up dispersing, and they look like a fish egg, so they're readily eaten by a number of creatures for whom they have a detrimental effect. And that's just one example of a they're small. You don't see them. They're not a big trash island in the middle of the ocean, but they have a significant effect, and from what I understand, the smaller that the particles become, the more integrated they get into the whole food web, and the more of an issue that we have as we're eating fish. And it was an interesting term that I hadn't heard before, but nurdled is my word of the week.
That's very good.
I was there.
So I won't go way off topic here. I've got another idea I've learned about in Singapore for some pallets made of biomaterial, but I won't go through that right now. So any more questions for this panel? Okay, great. Thank you so much for coming today, and keep us posted on what you're learning. It'd be fun for us to get an update every, once a year, however, whatever the interval you're learning new things at that seems relevant to be worth your time to come up here.
Great. Be happy to do so. Yeah, thanks.
Thank you.
Good luck with your research, Allie.
Thank you. Thank you so much.
Okay, so let's get... okay, so we've got Joel, Dave, and Patrick, and then another Dave to run the PowerPoint from our Food Industry Association and Tillamook, which is, it's an association, but it's a major provider as well on their own. I see you've brought your own PowerPoint. Man, here's is good. All right, so we're going to go for about 15 minutes and then take a little break. I assume we'll still be talking at that point. So it's not that we don't love you, it's just we got to go sign this bill and the governor's up there with his pen waiting, and so we're just going to go for a little while, then take a break, and then we'll come back if that's all right.
Sounds good.
Please, so whoever wants to begin.
You bet. Chair Klim, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Joel Fisher with the Oregon Business Association. I'm their senior policy analyst, although I'm not actually senior to anybody there.
good titles.
So I'm here, we're calling ourselves sort of the Food Industry Leadership Group, here with the Oregon Business Association, partnership between Oregon Business Association, the Oregon Business Council, who's not here today, Dave Saponi with Northwest Food Processors Association, and then we have two chairs of this group, one of whom is here today, Patrick Kreitzer with Tillamook Creamery Association, and another who couldn't be here, Sam Tannehill with A to Z Wineworks, A to Z and Rex Hill. So we're here to talk about the opportunities that are ahead in Oregon's food industry, and basically under the guiding principles of the Oregon Business Plan of creating 25,000 net new jobs per year, driving Oregon, growing Oregon's per capita income from the current place of 90% to above 100% of the U.S. average, and reducing Oregon's poverty rate, which is currently at 17.2%, reducing it to below 10%. So we're here not just to talk about the incredible opportunities that lie ahead with Oregon's food processing and food industry, but it's already a very strong industry. 637 total food processing locations in Oregon. 114 of those are in 23 of Oregon's rural counties. 54 of those 114 rural plants are in distressed counties. and they employ 24,700 direct jobs for a total of 14.2 billion total output and value added in 10 plus sectors in food and beverage, and that's things like fruit, vegetables, grains, etc. And one of the key things to remember here is that this is middle wage jobs. The average food and beverage compensation is pushing $49,000. And you can see from this graph that a lot of those jobs are kind of in between the $25,000, $35,000, $45,000 mark. Lots of opportunity. The global middle class right now stands at about 1 billion people in the global middle class, and we expect that to grow to 2 to 3 billion by 2030. This graph shows where those percentages lie, where the growth is lying, and you can see most of that growth is in Asia. And Oregon is situated particularly well to be exporting to those growing markets. So lots of opportunity ahead. So a couple of things to remember: opportunity in the growing global middle class, middle wage jobs, already a very strong food processing industry here in Oregon, and lots of opportunity for growth. And sorry, I'd like to turn it over to Dave Zapponi with Northwest Food Processors Association.
Thank you very much, Bill. My name is Dave Zapponi, Northwest Food Processors Association president, and we're celebrating our 100th anniversary this year. Chair Clem and the rest of the committee, thank you for this opportunity to address you. I want to give you a story about what's happening in Oregon, the food business, and it's a very good story. We have a solid foundation within the state because of our position in globally and the competitive advantages that we enjoy in the agricultural sector and the food processing industry, from climate to energy and the various costs that we have, soils, water, those are all important parts of our business. We have put together this industry-driven group so that industry is taking charge of its direction in food processing. That industry-driven directive has been supported by the state of Oregon, and I'd like to just show you a little bit about the results over the last 10 years with the food processing industry. It's about a $14-plus billion industry, so it's significant in this state. It's a strong economic base. It is the foundation of the economy in the Northwest, driven by a strong agricultural community, but also the commodities that we produce and have first or primary processing. Those are the outputs that you see there on the graph in red. It's a large part of what this state produces. The other point I'd like to make about this graphic is that we're highly diversified, a diversified portfolio, if you will, of different types of crops and products that we produce. That is important because it creates more stability in the industry. What we need to do is grow, and you can see on the chart there, that value-added segment where the multiplier effect, the economic multiplier, is increased. It's a very small amount at this point, and it should be a much larger amount, so it's one of the things we're looking at in our study. We do a great job of selling. Oregon does a great job of selling globally, domestically, and within our own state. And you can see from the graph that we use a lot of the products that we produce here locally, and that's an important component. But we also sell well to other parts of the United States, and we have a strong market in other parts of the United States. And right now there's a new change in sort of the food industry. As you see, there's a lot of unique niches that are being developed throughout the United States, and some of our companies are taking advantage of them because we're regionally, you know, small in the world of food processing, but regionally larger companies like Pacific Natural Foods and Tillamook are doing incredibly good jobs of capturing a niche market and growing within that market. What we need to do is work on the international component, and you can see that we only barely touch the international component, and so we have a lot of opportunity here to grow this industry. I'm going to tell you a little bit about the Oregon story per se, and you can take a look at the trends in employment versus in our state versus the whole of the United States. You'll note this is kind of the story over a 14-year period here. In 2000, in the year 2000, 2001, you can see that there's a gap between the red line, which is Oregon, and the black line, which is all industries or manufacturer, or excuse me, is the United States. That gap, that difference between there is sort of whether you're doing well comparatively against the other, the entire country. And you see, we started to split there in a negative way. The industry then responded. We recognized that we had a problem. They didn't know exactly what it was, but they recognized that there was a problem and took advantage of the community of food processors. It's unique to the Northwest, community of food processors, and started to address those issues. We put together what we call a cluster strategy. The cluster strategy looked at some of the issues that we were dealing with. We had to raise a little money to get to this point, and Oregon invested in the cluster strategy for the food processing industry, along with other states in the Northwest and other counties in Portland, et cetera. But we invested in the growth and did the study and came up with our priorities. Number one priority, just coincidentally, is innovation and a focus on innovation, which is we feel is very important. As you move forward, we were able to create the report that galvanized the industry, gave us a roadmap of where we're going. We went to the legislature and were able to work with the what was then OCED, Oregon Knowledge Economy, and created the Oregon Innovation Council from those discussions. And the Oregon Innovation Council, as I said, our number one objective was innovation, and we needed a way to improve the innovation in our committee or in our community. So we did that, and you can see shortly thereafter when we got a tranche of money to invest in projects and programs, and especially innovation, not just focused on productivity improvement, which tended to make us inwardly focused. We had to be outwardly focused. Innovation allowed us to do that. We started looking out, and lo and behold, we started outperforming the U.S. economy in food processing. And you can see the crossover point there, and you can see where we are today. The final arrow is that we've really separated the gap, and we're accelerating. We're increasing at an accelerated rate the number of jobs in the food industry. It is truly a success story. And let's take a look at what we did in Oregon in particular. And this particular graphic is really interesting and telling. I'd like to focus your attention on the black line. The black line is all other industries outside of food processing. In 2008, you'll note that there was a significant drop in the number of jobs. I don't think I'm telling you anything new. I just want to demonstrate that is on this graphic. You are familiar with this story. But what you may not be familiar with is the importance and what happened in the food industry. We actually grew jobs in the food industry, not only in the cities, but also in the rural communities that you are looking after in this committee. So we grew our jobs. We did a really good job of that. And during that recession, you can see how the accelerated rate with a little bit of investment and a lot of commitment by our leadership in the food industry, including Mr. Kreitzer here, we were able to turn this industry around from a negative to a positive and grow it and accelerate it. And the food industry has a tremendous future. And I'd like to pass the mic over to Patrick Kreitzer, CEO of Tillamook County Creamery, and he'll explain where we are now and where we're going.
Mr. Chair, can I ask a question before we... thanks for your presentation. Very interesting. Do you know or can you estimate what net job growth there was from that 2008 to current? That's a pretty exciting graph.
It's significant.
I think total jobs, you said, are about 25,000 direct employed jobs. I wonder what that... Just the number of jobs created in that growth curve. It would be interesting to know.
10 years, it was 4,400.
Yeah, 10 years, 4,400. Okay. That's why I have Dave here.
Thank you.
That's good. Thanks.
Yeah, Representative Unger.
Oh, thank you.
What you talked about innovation and the work that you did to create these jobs. What are some specific examples that you did that helped to create this boom in food processing?
Well, there's a couple areas that we really focused. We focused on the production of the production function of a food processing company, and that's the plant and equipment and what's going on there. One of the key things that we did, and actually I thank the legislature for this and the county governments, is that we passed a machinery and equipment property tax exemption, and that allowed us to what we found is earlier that we weren't actually reinvesting because we were trying to cut so much in the way of costs that we needed to stimulate reinvestment in our plants and equipment. And so passing that, it wasn't a lot of money, but it was enough to change the attitude in the industry and really get people to start thinking, well, you know, I really do need to invest more. And that was a major accomplishment and something that we've done. And that was in fruits and vegetables only, but it really helped drive the change. Other things that we've done in energy, for example, we have an energy efficiency program. So we really focused on what we can do to reduce our energy consumption. Energy efficiency is, output per unit of energy used. And the industry as a group, and we're the only industry in the entire United States that has done this, as a region, we've set goals for us to reduce our energy footprint. And so that's an important component. That allowed us to do that. What came out of that were metering projects that the Oregon Innovation Council money helped to fund, some productivity improvements, some equipment upgrades, and things like that that really helped focus in demonstration projects. We did Go Green Shippers, which is a shipping project that helped us to reduce the amount of air we ship and pack the containers more efficiently, and things like that. So there were a lot of activities that went on. I mean, we were busy. We were very busy as an industry. And we're at that, we're sort of at an inflection state right now where we're at a point where it's not in the crisis, we're in a growth mode where we could really make a significant growth in this industry and a permanent long-term economic benefit to the people of the state, including important middle-wage jobs. Those middle-wage jobs, and most of our, you saw the Joel's graphic, most of the jobs that we're creating are about, you know, on average $50,000 a year. In a community, that's really important. In a rural community, that's very, very important.
So we are going to take our little break. So I'm so sorry about this. This is just the way it is. This is when the governor is available. So we're going to take about a 10-minute recess, no more than 15. Our thing starts in 5 minutes, and we'll walk up there, those of us who are going to this meeting, and then we'll be back. And so, again, I apologize for interrupting you, but if you can just hang out for a little bit, we'll get this thing signed into law and be back down here.
Okay.
So we'll stand in, committee will stand in recess. Anybody wants to?
to and I don't know.
Did you just have the governor's office call you when they're ready?
Yeah, yeah. We're going to come back out of recess. Apparently there were other bills that passed in February. I didn't realize that. And there's other bills to be signed, and we're down the list somewhere, several minutes away still. So I thought we would come back, and we'll just do our thing. And when they're ready to sign it, they can call us, and then we'll go up there when it's convenient for us after that and see how that works. Okay, then. So are we ready to shift over to Patrick? Yeah, great. Welcome.
Chair Clem and committee, my name is Patrick Reitzer. I'm the president and CEO of the Tillamook County Creamery Association. Just briefly about TCCA, the association, we're a 105-year-old farmer-owned cooperative. We employ 500 people in Tillamook County, about 50 in Clackamas County, and almost 200 in Morrow County. We generate about $650 million in revenue, mostly from our branded food business, and most of that is traded outside of Oregon and increasingly internationally. So the global food marketplace is dynamic and ripe with opportunity for the companies and the regions that solve the complex problems, some of which Joel and Dave touched on earlier, around the growing middle class, consumer trends, you know, we see Oregon as very well positioned to take advantage and capitalize on that opportunity. You know, between our strong agricultural base, our proximity to these large markets in Asia and in California, notably, as well as the food culture here, you know, gives us that great opportunity to capitalize on those on what's happening in the global food marketplace. In order to accelerate the conversation about the small number of high leverage things that we can do as an industry and that we can do in public-private partnership in order to drive the food industry in Oregon and accelerate the growth of jobs, particularly in rural communities like the ones in which TCCA operates. Sam Tannehill of A to Z and Rex Hill and I have gotten together a group of food industry leaders from throughout the state, working in partnership with Northwest Food Processors Association, OBA, OBC, and frankly anyone else that wants to get into the conversation, and building on the strong work that Dave was talking about, the Northwest Food Processors Association has done. The idea is to work together as an industry to identify that small number of high leverage opportunities to drive the industry forward with the benefits that these guys spoke very well about earlier. To give you a sense of who's in the conversation, we've got a slide here. The approach is a very inclusive approach, one in which we're inviting, you know, kind of anyone that's interested in this topic to the table. But as you can see here from this list, we've focused on value-added food processing companies, particularly with the high opportunity and existing business to trade for traded revenues outside of Oregon, largely around the idea of branded food businesses. Top leaders from these companies, we got together a couple of weeks ago as a first meeting and have done some subsequent work in small groups since then. The main outcome of that first meeting as an industry group was to identify a set of six themes for further exploration. We're not sitting here today with those specific recommendations with regard to what we would do as an industry or what the public-private partnership opportunities might be, but I will touch on these themes briefly. Clearly at the top is the theme of innovation. The extent to which we can create an environment in which food companies are innovating in ways that meet specific consumer needs in the global food marketplace in Asia and domestically and locally, we're going to drive this industry. You grow a sector in the economy by growing the businesses within that sector, and you do that by serving consumers well. And so it's, you know, starts with that and starts with innovation. The next theme that we've identified is export and international trade. There are certainly tremendous opportunities for us from Oregon to for a well-coordinated effort, particularly into Asia, to serve the growing middle class there, and also to capitalize on what already exists in terms of strong Oregon brand equity there, and expand upon that. And that brings me to the next theme, which is branding. Two major thrusts around this theme. The first one being around talent. So Oregon already has a great reputation for as the place where good food comes from. And the more we're able to attract in the skilled and creative class of jobs, more we're able to attract people who say, I want to be in that dynamic industry, and Oregon is the place to work. And I know if I go there, I can build a career and be with other like-minded people, in the industry that are interested in the industry. The more we can do that, the more we're going to create a virtuous cycle of talent here in the state to drive that industry for us. The other piece of the branding effort is around a consumer-facing brand. We're doing so many things right here in Oregon already in food processing and agriculture and in the way we're approaching the environmental impacts of the industry that, you know, we're already getting a lot of credit for, but there's an opportunity to get more there. The next theme I'll talk about just briefly is workforce. I talked about attracting talent into the higher skilled and more creative kind of job classifications. There's also an opportunity, particularly as the food industry has relevance in rural communities, an opportunity to ensure that we've got well-trained and well-qualified workforces for all kinds of jobs that are important to this industry, whether it be through vocational training in through rural community colleges and various other programs, and many of which are already benefiting from partnerships between local businesses. And, for example, we've got a partnership with other businesses in Tillamook County to drive vocational training that create the skills that we need in our businesses through the Tillamook Bay Community College. The environment in which we exist, both from a infrastructure, supply chain, environmental, regulatory, and so forth, needs to be competitive in order for us to attract and retain the businesses we have here. And then finally, the last theme that we've identified is access to capital. And there's some, you know, the more we create this virtuous cycle of innovation, energy, and creativity around the food industry in Oregon, the more we're going to have the opportunity to access capital. So just wanted to lay out, you know, at the point where we are now, wanted to sort of lay out for you where the themes that we've identified. The goal is to continue to get this group together, work closely with the Northwest Food Processors Association within the construct of the clustering activity that they've created, which has been so successful, as you saw earlier, also with OBC, OBA, and, of course, everyone else that's interested in the conversation, in order to have a strong industry-led set of activities around the development of the food industry in Oregon. So I think I'll stop there and see if there are questions.
Yeah, I'm sure we may have some more conversation after our bill signing, actually, before we let you go, if you've got time. But any questions initially? And so, Representative Holden, then I'll
just real briefly, I'm kind of curious what kind of skills in the workforce are really the most attractive to your industry, I suppose. I mean, what are you really looking for a highly skilled workforce?
Well, I think there are a couple of areas where that are super important to our business and present some challenges. And I can just speak for Tillamook, and Dave may have a broader industry perspective as well. But certainly, as our manufacturing operations become more automated, skills around controls, automation, and the operation of more technical equipment and machinery are important to us, and maintenance of that type of equipment. Those are super important jobs to us as we as we grow within the state. The other area is around food science, R&D, and the development of products to meet the trends in consumer demand.
That's that is perhaps one of the. This is Dave Zappone and Sharon Clem. Thank you. One of the key areas that we're focusing on. Most of the processors have those middle skill jobs, and that there's a real challenge to get welders, sanitation people, maintenance people. There's a program that OSU started a while back. Go Beavers, right? Mm-hmm. So that is called mechatronics, and it's the mechanics that we used to be familiar with or are familiar with, but the electronics part of that is really critical now. As Patrick mentioned, there's electronics that we use a lot of metering and special equipment. And if you go in a plant, if you have an opportunity to go into a plant, you'll see that it's not masses of bodies there kind of sweeping the floors. It's really people sitting at monitors and screens and using highly sophisticated equipment. So supporting those equipment on how to run it and to run the plant, but also maintaining it is what we're really looking at it today. So those are huge and important jobs for us that we have to do. The other side of the coin is getting qualified business people in the plants, and we're trying to attract managers. And so the strategy that we're employing, as we get sexier, we're going to be uh-huh. more attractive to bring people in. But what we've tried to do is bring in the incumbent workers, or work with the incumbent workers. So we draw from the communities, especially in rural communities, where families like to stay together, and especially families that are of minority families and other types. They like to stay in the same community. So we want to bring them into the plant, get them working on the lines, and then grow them from there. We can identify those really smart people that need to go to the next level. And so we need to provide worker training in the plants, and so that they can become leads and then supervisors and then managers in our plants. And that's the strategy that we're looking at right now. We're tying into the university system and the community college. Community college is going to give us sort of that mid-tier, the advanced skill employees. And if we can identify from those people that can move on to be actual plant managers, that's when we're going to go to the four-year colleges. And we're talking to OSU, of course, and the WSU is putting together a special program that's tying into the Blue Mountain Community College and some of the other ones. So we're working on that right now. So we have a lot of needs for jobs, and we're growing so fast, we're trying to get those systems in place as quickly as possible.
So I'm going to hand the gavel over, and you can call on yourself next, and I'll go upstairs, because I don't want to make you have to wait again. I feel bad about the delay anyway, so I'm going to go upstairs to our deal, and if you're still here, and we get back. If not, I just want to say we've been noticing on the yogurts the inclusion of the word Oregon a lot more, like an Oregon Marionberry. We think that's fantastic. I just think it's so cool, and I've seen them on the shelf in other countries. I'm like, hey, look at that. Yeah, that's where I'm from. They're like, oh, yeah, okay, now they can have some context to what I claim I'm supposedly representing when I come from Oregon. Because they're like, oh, I've had that. That's great. So thank you for that.
Thank you.
Thank you.
I didn't get called on. Sorry about that. Speaking out of Oregon like that.
You still had the gavel. I appreciate you being here. This is very exciting for us. I had a couple of questions prior to our recess, and one of them had to do with the if you hit the low-hanging fruit in this upturn, which was energy efficiency and investment in equipment, what's next? Is there some, and you may have touched on that with your last question, and I apologize for walking in a few minutes late. That was a piece of it. And the next one is we made an investment in the fermentation sciences program at Oregon State. We're trying hard to make sure that we're educating people well to grow the industry. But are there gaps? What else do we need to be looking at as institutions of higher ed with community college apprenticeship programs with OUS, or what isn't OUS anymore? What are we calling it? Our university system, and where are the gaps that you see that we need to be concerned about in training to continue with this growth?
Well, Vice Chairman McCown,
it's McEwen.
McEwen, I'm sorry.
It's not your problem. You get a pass. Absolutely, okay. Get a pass. But listen.
Thank you. One way that I would answer the question is that the work that we're doing as an industry today in terms of identifying these six major themes is intended to answer in very specific ways the questions you're asking. What's next? I don't know. I don't want to I don't want to, I've got ideas, of course, but I don't want to answer those very, you know, I don't want to answer that in a, with a very specific list other than sort of the themes that that we kind of just went through. But however, the, you know, creating that environment in which innovation in the food industry, food and beverage industries and the fermentation science program is one that we work with closely at Tillamook as well. Creating that environment where there's that the kinds of research going on, and there's the partnership between industry and our institutions of higher learning and research is one critical aspect of how we'll develop the products that are value added that meet the demands of the global food marketplace, of consumers in the global food marketplace. So that's got to be a focus for us in terms of creating those the capability and the amount of activity that will attract the right sorts of talent into those programs. You know, I think the vision needs to be that if you're interested in the food industry and in food science and in the incredible powerful intersection between business and food science, that Oregon is the place that you want to go, whether it be Oregon State or one of the other universities in the system, or whether you just want to come out here and leverage your experience and use that into a job, or you want to stay in Oregon and stay in our university system because that's the industry you want to be a part of. So that's got to be a top part of sort of what's next and answering the question, what's next. You know, the conversation that we have going now across the industry, along with the kind of localized clustering conversations that the Northwest Food Processor Association has developed, are, you know, that's going to be the best source of sort of that specific list of what do we do as an industry, what do we do in public-private partnership in order to drive the industry. And, you know, the goal here is to identify that small number of highly leveraged things, recognizing that, you know, creating another, organization or mass program to sort of drive a particular industry is probably not how we're going to get there.
Okay. Thank you.
I'll follow up on another question. I'm sure you probably are thinking about all the different aspects of your skilled workforce, going back to your workforce and how to get people skilled up so they're productive for you right at the get-go. So does the Food Processor Association or, you know, your group, are they looking at with their community college partners or other partners of also using on-the-job training, you know, potentials, you know, starter wages where people are able to, you know, get a wage and learn the, you know, like the millwright aspect and all the electronics to run all the equipment and all that? Because it seems like that's so specific that you would have to have, you know, that on-the-job training aspect to get somebody skilled up. And so is the association looking at, I guess, a more, you know, an industry-wide sort of on-the-job training program where people can plug in? Because when I go visit Ninkasi or King Estate or some of the other and look at their, you know, their processing part of it, you know, it's really high tech. And, you know, it's, so you have your food science over here, but then you have your processing part over here, and they're really different training elements. And so anyway, I was just kind of asking whether you're thinking about long term of having association wide, you know, on the job training pieces for people to get involved in.
Vice Chair McEwen.
Thank you.
And Representative Foley. Dave Zappone of Northwest Food Processors. I will say that's a definite yes. We're looking at that. The Northwest Food Processors Association has a program and is looking at that. But importantly, we have what we call it's a foundation, the Education and Research Institute, that is focusing on that very question. And I had a meeting two weeks ago with the, it's our annual board meeting with the, we call it the ERI, Education Research Institute. And their focus is community benefit, and they're a special type of organization to do that. We give scholarships, four-year scholarships, to the three land-grant universities in the three Northwest states that we represent. But The board of directors said that they want to do more with internships and incumbent worker training, and they specifically focused on that at this meeting, and they're working on a solution to make that happen. We are looking at other ways to communicate with plants to help them, if we can, and in developing their courses and that type of a training program. NWFPA has recently, within the last couple of months, released a new platform, the Food Resources and Education Institute, FREDI, and we have FRED Talks to train incumbent workers or anyone who wants to use it. It's a freeware by and large, but it also has a component for online training, and then we have a live component where we go out and we teach specialized skills within the industry. I won't get into the acronyms, but there are certain types of skills and certifications that we need, and we will help facilitate that, especially in rural communities. And it's difficult for boardmen to have safe quality food certification instructors go out there because it's out of the way, it's costly, it takes a whole day and 2 days for them to go in and out. But with the association amassing all of the different clusters of food clusters around the state, we're able to have enough buying clout to say, hey, look, you need to go out there. So we have various systems in place currently to help us. That whole area, that discussion of how we're going to fill the pipeline, we have the strategy, of course, bringing in special communities of people working in our plants and speaking to them in their language and helping them grow. I think we have one plant here in Portland that has, I think, 36 different nationalities there, or I should say different languages. And that's huge. Now, how do you take care of that? Well, we're developing strategies to make sure that we can communicate to those people as well and grow them up. So it's a very complicated situation, but yes, the short answer is yes, we're looking at that. We have some things in place, and we're planning to grow those.
Thank you. Any other questions?
I'll just try to remember Freddie.
Yeah, fredtalks.com. Go on, it's really...
fredtalks.com.
Right, and that was partially funded by the Oregon Innovation Council when we started doing some of our work and studied what the needs were in the industry, and that popped up as one of the key innovations, and so we set up a new business model to make that work. Very good.
Thank you very much for your time, gentlemen. We appreciate you being here. We look forward to another report in the future.
Yeah.
I think in the spirit of continuing to move along, even though we are short some colleagues, I'm assuming that they will be down here very soon. I think we'll go ahead and bring up our next panel on our industrial lands program. And I'd like to invite up Mr. Is it Van Huffel?
Yes.
My presenter. Thank you. Mr. Campbell, Alex, and Sierra Gardner.
Gardner.
Thank you. I'm sorry. It's handwritten. Thank you for being here.
Thank
Welcome.
You. Vice Chair McEwen and committee members, again, thank you for the opportunity to talk about industrial lands, update you. Again, my name is Gary Van Huffel. I'm the Business Development Manager for Business Oregon. I've invited Sierra Gardner, our industrial land specialist, to be with us, as well as Alex Campbell, the director of the Umpqua Economic Development Partnership. So I think what we'd like to do is kind of bring you up to date on our existing programs, and I want to talk a little bit more about the programs you passed in 2013, update you on those, and of course then I would like to follow up with Alex giving you a little background about his experience with these programs and in the Umpqua Valley. All right? So with that, I'll turn it over to Sierra.
I'm Sierra Gardner. Thank you for having me, Vice Chair McEwen and committee. I'm Sierra Gardner. I'm the Industrial Land Specialist for Business Oregon, and I'm going to just talk about certification and Senate Bill 766, which are the programs that I manage. As you know, site certification is one of Business Oregon's most popular programs. That's because it's been around for over a decade, and we have some pretty great wins, such as Facebook in Prineville and Google in the Dalles, among others. Certification program is a program that's offered to both public and private site owners. which is pretty unique as far as public programs go. We basically give an opportunity for the site owners to look at and examine their sites for their market readiness. So we look at contamination, we look at wetlands, archaeological findings, everything from transportation. It's a very thorough process. So once we do that, we certify the site, and we consider it kind of a premier site in the state of Oregon. So that means that we showcase it to site selectors when they come to town, whenever we're working with companies locally. When companies are looking to expand, we make sure that they're right out front and center. We identify program constraints, but we also look to prospect employers when we're working with these sites. So we're looking for sites that have access to road and river and rail. We're looking for sites that are really that are going to be actually developed. So another program that I manage is Senate Bill 766. That's regionally significant industrial areas and projects of state significance. We've designated four so far, one yesterday, projects of regionally significant industrial areas. That includes Goshen, Douglas County, Hermiston, and Grants Pass. Alex will talk a little bit more about that. And then something that might be of interest to this particular committee is, our industrial land programs really focus on vacant industrial land sites in the state of Oregon. And as you know, the metropolitan areas are really built out, and they're very expensive. So the capacity that we have right now in potential development is really in the rural communities. And that's along eastern Oregon, I-84, and southern Oregon, I-5 South. So particularly I-84 right now is a big interest to us because we're looking at a lot of port opportunities there. We have great intermodal transportation opportunities that run interstate-wide, and we have a lot of sites that are ready for development. So with that, one more thing I should mention. As of March 2013, we've asked the regionally significant, regional solutions teams to create priorities for us. And the reason why we did this is because the communities are really going to know best. You know, we're centrally located here in Salem, and I'm always in the community. I go all over the state all the time, but they know best what they need. And we offer a whole portfolio of programs. We offer site certification, regionally significant industrial areas, but they're all different. So different communities are going to need different things. They're going to understand their infrastructure needs, and the regional solutions teams are best fit to help coordinate interagency efforts. So we've asked them to create strategies for each region, and we're hoping that will work out beautifully this year.
Just a quick question. You mentioned that so far you've identified four areas. Were those self-selected and came forward, or were you looking for those? How were those identified?
Those are actually, we market the program, and we work pretty closely with all the communities, but each of those communities came forward to us, and then we designate it. They're nominated by a sponsor. It's usually a number of sites, both public and private can apply. And then the area is designated to create basically a industrial sanctuary. So it protects the zoning code on the area.
You're looking for clusters, in essence.
We're looking for clusters. We're looking for significant areas that have opportunities for transportation, really great opportunities for industrial traded sector, advanced manufacturing.
Thank you.
With that, I'd like to talk about the programs that were established in 2013, which is Senate Bill 246 and 253. I recognize the legislature really began to understand that site readiness was an important tool for the state. And so Senate Bill 246 was the one that, again, looked at loan forgiveness for developing industrial sites within the state that were designated as regionally significant industrial sites. Same process as regionally significant industrial areas. They have to meet the same criteria, but they identified those sites where really that both public and private sector were going to invest in the readiness of that site. That's become more important, I think, for both business recruitment and business expansion within the state, as the speed to market is becoming very critical for companies wanting to expand or relocate. So this program will help with that. So it allows them, again, the sites to be designated using the regional solution teams as the kind of the work team that actually develops the evaluates the nomination, makes a recommendation to us, and then of course the sponsor would actually then enter into an agreement with the property owner or the company that wants to develop the site for the future forgiveness of some of the loan based on the quality jobs created on that site. So very much like a lot of our other programs within the agency. The other one I think that was recognized by the legislature is that we still don't have a full understanding of a lot of the industrial lands within the state, particularly out in a lot of the rural counties and other regions. And so the Senate Bill 253 identified a grant program for doing regional inventories and classifications of industrial property, as well as doing assessments on known industrial sites like some of the certified sites and regionally significant industrial sites. Of course, there was no funding for that, but again, a lot of local communities and regions are actually thinking about this and starting to prioritize their industrial sites and patterning after what Metro did with the large lot inventory in their region. With that, I think I'll let Alex talk a little bit about their experience.
Thank you. Vice Chair Kuehn, thank you for giving me a little time to talk about the perspective of the user, I guess, in some senses. So we, Alex Campbell, Partnership for Economic Development in Douglas County, we looked at the RSIA program. We saw it as an opportunity to add an additional marketing tool to our toolkit, and we also saw the potential access to additional state resources as a valuable piece of it. And we are also attracted by the land use lock-in piece of it that Sierra mentioned. So we requested designation of what we called the Central Douglas RSIA. It includes two private and one publicly owned site. Between the three sites, we designated about 350 acres that are in that industrial area. One greenfield, two redevelopment sites. And I think it's important to note or interesting to note that on one of those is a former airport, and the original or the current uses of the pieces that have been developed, a couple of those were recruitments, and one of them was also a significant expansion for Aranco Systems, which is one of the primary employers in Sutherland. They're up to about 300 employees now. And so the industrial land inventory in Douglas County we is obviously critical to both our recruitment and our retention and expansion opportunities. As far as our experience with the process, I think it was really quite easy to use. It's a pleasure to have a state program that was not overly burdensome. The substantive questions were direct to the purpose of the program. We worked with some very willing property owners, which was one of the things that we were a little bit nervous about. You know, you are locking in the zoning to industrial use. We had several property owners that understood the vision there and were committed to the long-term development of their property. And I think it's a well-designed program and that is very sort of stackable. I mean, all of these sites that I'm talking about they're site certified, they're in a regionally significant industrial area, and they're all in the enterprise zone. So I think all three of those programs really work well together. In terms of outcomes to date, we haven't landed any projects yet. As I'm sure you're all aware, we've had a lot of inventory of existing buildings, particularly and land in metro areas, and we haven't yet seen a lot of significant greenfield development outside of metro areas. But I think we're in a good position to be prepared as more activity like that hopefully occurs in the future. But I think it was a really positive experience with our stakeholders, you know, to communicate with us property owners and understand their goals for the property and let them know that we're looking for every tool available to help them develop those sites. City of Sutherland received a TGM grant. They're doing an economic opportunity opportunities analysis that covers a couple of two pieces of that RSIA, and so we're going to be improving our understanding of the subparcel levels. We still face a lot of barriers and needs, you know, on these sites, though. As I said, one of them is a greenfield site. It has wetlands. It is a significant distance from the sewer collection system. The former airport site still needs waterline upgrades. Another site that is rail-served and at a new interchange, I think, is a very attractive industrial site, still needs the internal access road. So the additional resources that Gary was speaking about that you all are considering or will be considering making available are a big piece of really making the RSIA program work for us from our perspective. So I appreciate the opportunity to come and talk to you a little bit today.
So well, any questions? I've got some too, but I almost called you Senator Thatcher. Representative Thatcher.
But it works.
I'm just training myself. I hope you vote for my
Thank
bills,
you. Senator. I was just trying to catch up on some of the terms used. TGM grant.
Yeah, the Transportation Growth Management.
Thank you.
Yeah.
Okay. I just, you know, all these acronyms. Also, remind me, and you might have said it already, but I missed it. What are green fields exactly?
So a greenfield site is a site that's never been used for development
okay.
purposes.
Okay.
So.
Thank you. That's all I have.
And just to say a little bit more about that, so a pasture land, 200-acre site within a couple minutes of I-5. It could make a really outstanding both data center or corporate campus-type site, but it's one of those sites that we would need a really significant size project to justify the additional infrastructure that's needed to actually connect that to the pipe systems. And then the two other sites, one is a former mill site, and the private owners have put a lot of money into making that ready for redevelopment, and the third is a former airport site, as I mentioned.
Well, I guess I do have a follow-up.
Yeah, follow-up.
What are the minimum size, partly you just mentioned mm-hmm. a pasture, what are the minimum sizes you would be of land, that you would be acreage sizes that you would be looking for industrial?
There aren't any minimum for the RISIA program. However, we are looking for bigger sites, and that's because we're looking for employers who would have projects that would pencil out.
Bigger as in what, 20 acres, 30
acres? Oh,
pardon
me, 50 acres or more.
50, okay. Picture my mind, thanks.
Vice Chair McKeown.
Oh, Ms. Gardner, you mentioned four areas, and I was able to quickly jot down two, Grants Pass and Douglas. What were the other two areas?
Hermiston and Goshen.
Goshen, thank you.
Hermiston was designated yesterday.
That's the new one.
Okay. Grants Pass was in March.
And how many do you anticipate in the next... What does your future look like in designating sites?
We have a pretty good pipeline right now. We've got about five candidates in the pipeline. However, it's hard to say if they're going to come all the way forward. These have to be previously zoned industrial sites, and they have to show that they're ready for development, that they're significant to the region. So the application process, as Alex mentioned, is not necessarily cumbersome, but it's something that, you know, the communities have to come together to work on. And then we go through a public hearing process, and it goes forward in a rule, which essentially designates a industrial sanctuary for 10 years.
Thank you.
So, you know, just for the committee's benefit, the reason this is on the agenda, one of the things that I've been thinking about a lot, actually, coming out of the land use bill from last session, some of the negotiations we had with smaller cities were what they had dreams of for their industrial lands. And so I wanted, you know, and this is just one of, I think we next interim committee days we'll have another presentation on industrial lands. I want to really use the interim sort of get it, you know, get at the actual situation on the ground. So, you know, we just did something relatively recently, the regionally significant industrial. We had already, though, this program, and yet a lot of what we work from is anecdotal, which is, no, there's plenty available already, or, no, there's literally zero available. And I just want to find the truth, wherever that is. If there's not enough available, we got to do more things, and that's what we got to do. If there's, no, there's tons, but they're expensive because they're old mills. And, yeah, there's a lot, but nobody's willing right now to put the cash in to get them ready for another use because they don't have the cash, or they don't know if, you know, we're going to start getting access to some more wood, so they don't want to give up on that. I mean, we got to find out what the actual situation is, because it's difficult for us. We'll have one of our colleagues from Ontario come over and tell us we need more. Then back in my office, someone else is saying, well, no, they already have that. Well, I got to get facts here. I can't just listen to, you know, both people I think are honest people, so somewhere there's a truth, and that's my goal in having these hearings, is to try and get at what the actual situation is. And are the programs we've already done not producing enough supply? Are they? Are they not working? You know, maybe could they be tweaked? So that's the point of this.
Chairman Clem, part of the answer is I think Senate Bill 253 was hopefully going to address that issue, mm-hmm. doing the regional inventories and classification of sites. I would say, as I mentioned earlier, though, a lot of regions are actually starting to try to start that process on their own, too, with some of our help. But obviously, the grants would certainly assist them.
Mm-hmm.
And I think you've got some more comments there, too, so Sierra.
Yeah.
I'd love to. Thank you, Chair, for that question. It's a great opportunity for me to talk about what's going to happen in the future with these programs. So we've got it's a really great toolbox now to get us in a position where we can really understand the buildability of these areas, because you know, we have comprehensive plans. We know that there's industrial zone land out there, but what we don't know is the buildability. We don't necessarily understand, do we have the workforce that will offer the correct kind of workforce that we're looking for different industry profiles. And what we want is a traded sector. There's a lot of opportunities for growth on these sites, but what we want to find out right now is what infrastructure needs do they have? What transportation needs do they have? What's their accessibility to ports? What's their slopes? What's their contamination? Do they have wetlands? So we're going to kind of get in the weeds with some of these inventories, and the communities are going to be in the best position to provide that information. However, they don't necessarily have the funding or resources in many cases to get to that point. And so we're hoping that some of these programs will get funded.
So, Alex, tell me more about, you know, sort of the state of industrial lands in Douglas County, even prior to the most recent, you know, program. Do you feel there were many times people came by and you just didn't have anywhere to point them to, or no, there's some places, but there's other factors, you know, that aren't land-related, but are whatever, the cost of our minimum wage, or whatever things, you know, you see when you're talking to businesses.
Yeah. Thank you, Representative Clem. The challenges, as you're sort of intimating, are really pretty complex, and they go to a range of characteristics of a given site. There's probably 10, 15 different, you know, primary characteristics of a site, and what the particular priorities are for that individual user. You know, are they a heavy water user? Are they going to be need industrial pretreatment on the wastewater side? Do they have a significant power needs? Do they need rail service? What's their project development timeline? And so how sensitive would they be to, you know, whether you've got a wetland permitting issue on that ground? So to take you through some of the strengths and weaknesses of the three sites that we brought forward. The first, the rail service site, the former mill site that we have, is probably the most development ready of the three sub areas. It's about 100 acres. There is a looped water line in place. There are a couple different ways you might serve it with sewer, and there you got to get under I-5 to get to the collection system. So there's some question about the wisdom of making that investment prior to knowing exactly what your user looks like. So it needs an access road, exactly the right timing for doing that. is a challenge. In this case, what we're dealing with is it's a forest products manufacturer. They acquired this site. They are developers by happenstance. They acquired this site from Roseburg Forest Products really to improve their own access and protect their own access. So now they own 100 acres of industrial land. They've put a fair amount of money into it, but you know, their primary business is running their business. So a forgivable loan program, I think, would be a great tool for them when they're thinking about maybe putting in that access road, which is sort of the key piece of infrastructure there that's missing. They have they have a clean bill of health. They have no further action on the environmental side. All the wetlands issues have been taken care of. So that's a truly project ready site. The former airport site, we have wetlands issues. And honestly, we don't spend a lot of time talking about it with potential businesses. Why would you mess with a wetland site given the development time frames involved? If there's inventory available that works for you, that you don't have to deal with that mess, why would you?
Mm-hmm.
On the other hand, that site is county owned, and we can write down land costs. So in terms of an expansion site for existing companies that are in that area and might be willing to accommodate a longer time frame, you know, that might be a really attractive use. And we actually have a local food processor that we've been having some of those discussions with about that site. And then the Greenfield site is going to become a data center within the next 5 years, unless we can find a more job-intensive use to attract there first. It's less than a mile off the BPA grid. It's got 100 megawatts of power available to it. It's really close to the backbone. Tier 3 fiber runs really close to the site. It has wetlands issues. You need almost a mile of sewer pipe to serve it. So it's going to take a big project to make that pencil, but it's 200 acres. So it's one of those sites that somebody's going to come in, and they're not going to have a lot of choices in the western U.S. If they want that level of power, they want I-5 accessibility, and they want a really large footprint. So that's a little bit of the finer grain of the issues that we're looking at.
Interesting. And how about, in the county generally, I grew up in Coos County, so where Representative McEwen represents, I know the inventory of old mills, but I don't actually know how dire the situation, got is in Douglas County. Mm-hmm. Are there a lot of old mill sites, or is this the one that you're just described, a few that aren't?
There are a couple with existing buildings that may have some value or may not, but we certainly have, your first blush inventory when you look at a gross list of, there are five sites that are 50 acres or more, but beyond those three that I talked about, there are not that many that are readily developable. They have challenges.
Yeah. And then I'll come back to my question in a second. Vice Chair McEwen.
First of all, congratulations on being designated as an area. I think that speaks very well for the work that you've done and the potential for growth.
Thanks.
But you have another piece of industrial property in your county that I haven't heard mentioned, and it's
sure.
The IP property, which I'm sure you knew I was going to bring up.
Well, I was going there.
Outside the designated area, it's not on the I-5 corridor, but it does have assets. Is that a part of the discussion to Representative Clem's?
Yeah, thank you, Chair Clem and Representative McEwen. In fact, we had some pretty detailed discussions about maybe proposing that IP site for this program, and ultimately what the the determination to not do that was we felt we only wanted to propose sites where we had clear buy-in from the property owner in terms of that land use piece, and we did not have that there. So the next sort of two sites that I would have talked about in response to the Chair Clem's question would have been a site we call Dixonville, just east of Roseburg, that is another very large footprint site, has great power. It is a significant distance from water, and so fire suppression issues, you know, I mean, it's I don't see that site developing in the, you know, foreseeable future. And then the IP site is a really amazing site in terms of it's got water rights, it's got huge footprint, it's got huge power availability. It is a little bit off the I-5 corridor, but again, it represents a pretty interesting and unique problem because there's a fairly small universe of potential users of that site that would really use it to its full advantage. And I think those are the only users that make sense for that site, right? Anybody who is not going to take advantage of the full capabilities of that site, why bite off that much? So I think that's a case where, you know, it's a marketing and communication challenge as much as anything in my mind, is finding the channels to identify those potential users, and they're really global because there just aren't that many.
And that is also augmented now by American Bridge being next door, which also has rail and water access.
Absolutely.
So there's it's becoming a more complex site now.
Absolutely.
Yeah, it sort of feels to me like, you know, one option that we hear about or talk about is, you know, well, Texas, you can just get flat land anywhere. But obviously, you got to pay for the infrastructure to these projects, otherwise they don't develop. Even if it's just a greenfield, you still got to get the access road, you still got to get, you know, some power there. And so that's one of the questions I'm sort of struggling with is, you know, we generally in our system of land use want to promote redevelopment, but at some level, if the property owner doesn't find it economically viable to redevelop, then you get pressure for let's expand the UGB to get more industrial land because these sites in there just are too expensive to remediate. But you don't really want to promote that because then you have blight in the middle of your town, and you don't, you know, I mean, I think Detroit's going to tear down 40,000 buildings or something because their economy tanked badly and they've got all these decrepit things. And so it seems like there is a role, personally, I view, it seems like there is a role for the public to step in and help even a private landowner, and I don't consider it corporate welfare to help somebody get their site ready, you know, as long as we get some jobs and get some payback. Some people definitely aren't interested in those kind of programs, but I actually kind of liked the concept, as long as there's a way for the public to recoup its investment through something, income taxes, something, it seems to me appropriate versus the alternative, which is we'll just let the, you know, property owner, that's their problem, and then maybe we'll move the UGB out and, you know, some farmer will sell his field, and then we don't have to deal with all that mess. Well, that mess still has to get dealt with sometime by somebody. And if you let the farmer sell his place, he's happy because he got a bunch of cash, but then who's going to pay for that road to get out there? And so it's a complicated situation. There's not just an easy, well, let's all go to Texas and we got land. You know, that doesn't really work either.
Chair Clem, I really appreciate your point. I the other piece of it that I would emphasize, and that I think that the tools that have been we've been talking about today, and the potential additional tools, really make sense in that they're targeted not so much at land cost, because ultimately that's a tiny portion of the total cost of it, of even the capital cost, let alone the long-term, you know, operating cost of one of these projects. But they are specifically targeted at the development timeline, and that's the, other than workforce, that's the game.
Yeah.
Can I add to that? Thank you for that comment. And I just want to add that the programs in our portfolio are on a short-term and long-term timeline. So we've got different tiers, really. The certification shows that the site can be developed within 180 days, whereas the RISIA program is more of a long-term strategy. It's almost an approach. And we don't see those sites turn over quickly, but it's as you said, it's complicated and it takes time. So we want to make sure that we give it the appropriate amount of time and consideration as we develop. But most of the industrial land in the state of Oregon is devoted to industrial or was designated industrial because it was previously industrial. Yeah. So it's there for a reason in most cases, and it's usually about its proximity or access. And so a lot of the land that we're looking at, even if it has been a green field for many years or hasn't been developed yet, was designated for a reason. So we're hoping to really identify some of our more the better sites. But again, everything that's the low-hanging fruit in the state has already been developed, and so it's not going to be easy, this task.
And Chairman Clem, I'd like to add one other thing, too. Part of this process for the designations and the nominations has really been an education process for local governments, so both city and county. And the last one we did, Grants Pass, they commented what an education that was for their city council, finally starting to understand what the implications are of land use and transportation, industrial and commercial areas. So it's been a great educational tool.
I think we would like to be kept apprised. Obviously, you know, 766 is relatively new, and there's just a few a day ago or today and a month or 2 months ago. And so I know Goshen maybe the first. That was the first one I read about anyway. So I think we want to be kept abreast of the pace at which that's going, how it's going, and then also if there's things we just didn't think about when we were writing that bill that, you know, you probably should tweak this and it would work a little better. It was a way to create some sort of fast tracking to seize opportunities that existed. But you know, it's still something we're going to have to dig into at some point. Where every time I hear people say wetlands, it's like, they're important. They serve a purpose in the environment. We've got to figure out a way where it's not such a painful thing to even hear the word. There are wetlands issues. That's just not something I want to be a negative in the end, but I know it is at the moment. So we got to figure out some better way where you get the environmental outcome you want more quickly. So you can then you still achieve what you need to achieve environmentally, but it's just not such a painful thing to even have to consider going through. And I don't know enough about the process to know why it is, but I don't know anybody who, when they hear there's a wetlands issue, doesn't immediately groan and think about how to get through it on either side. I mean, even the environmental community, I think, is trying to do their best to figure out how to, you know, around Bandon, but they always run up against some farmer who says, hey, you know, I could farm that. Why are you doing that? That was a cranberry bog. And then you got to talk about why the ecosystem still needs wetlands, and it's an uncomfortable place for all of us to have to deal with, but I don't think we can just walk away because Oregon's pretty wet, it turns out. The west side, anyway.
West side.
Okay, anybody else?
Thank you.
Yeah, and we'll be back on this topic again in September.
Great.
Yeah, we'll probably
Thank
be
you.
On
Thank
it
you.
A lot. Thank you. Yeah. You bet. And with that, any final words from our departing colleague here?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. It's been an honor to serve with all of you. Thanks for your leadership.
Thank you for your partnership. With that, we will adjourn the committee.